Welcome to Your Cases on Hold, a JBJS podcast hosted by Antonia Chen and Andrew Schoenfeld.
Here, we discuss the science of each issue of JBJS with an additional dose of entertainment and pop culture.
Take us with you in the gym, on the commute, or most certainly, whenever your case is on hold.
Welcome back to the middle of July to another episode of Your Case is on Hold. We're excited to have you here. And we have a great lineup here of topics to talk about. So hopefully you're enjoying your summer, either nice and cool or nice and warm, whichever direction you like. As an introduction, I'm Antonia Chen, executive editor at JBJS. And I have here...
Andrew Schoenfeld, deputy editor for Movements.
We're thankful to have you guys here. And we're going to talk about what's on top of the pile. But before doing so, I'd let you know that this is brought to you by JBJS CME. Get your learn on. There's a lot of information out there. So for top of the pile, we start with What's New in Orthopedic Trauma by COP, and it's permanently free. Voluntary Incident Reporting in Healthcare, Genesis, Challenges and Opportunity by Marcus. Scars of Courage, UPL, and it's permanently free. Medical Training is Like Driver's Education, Bitterman, and it's permanently free. Definitely intriguing title. Enabling Technology in Fracture Surgery, State of the Art by Fareed. Colorado Limb Donning Timed Up and Go, it's called Cold Tug Test, in Lower Extremity Amputation, Less Donning Time with Osteointegrated Bone Anchored Prosthetic Limb by Awad et al. A Too Long Anterior Process of the Calcaneus, Defining Normative Values for the Calconavicular Distance Using MRI in a Pediatric Population by Prolong Gonzorli et al., and it's permanently free. The Effect of Traction and Spinal Cord Morphology on Intraoperative Neuromonitoring Alerts in Adolescent Idiopathic Scoliosis by Haddon et al. Litigation Patterns of Acute Compartment Syndrome, Distinctions Between Orthopedic and Non-Orthopedic Cases, and Factors Predicting Successful Defense by Arif et al. And it's 30 days free along with the visual summary. And then Completely Displaced Mid-Shaft Clavicular Fractures with Skin Tenting in Adolescents, results from the FACTS Multicenter Prospective Cohort Study by Williman et al. We're going to switch things up a little bit here this time, and we're going to start with our Your Cases on Hold featurette. It's on 300 periprosthetic tibial fractures around a total knee replacement, classification, and outcomes from a single institution by Dugali et al. There's a commentary and an infographic on this. So periprosthetic tibial fractures around a total knee replacement occur, but there's typically minimal data around this with small data sets, especially since they're a rare occurrence. So the purpose of this Mayo study was to review the types, management techniques, and outcomes of periprosthetic tibial fractures around total knee replacements. And this is an update to a previous Mayo study that had looked at periprosthetic tibial fractures from 1970 to 1995. So the current study looks at a time frame between 1996 and 2020, and it evaluated 351 periprosthetic tibial fractures. And fractures were excluded for having insufficient information to classify the fracture type, or having previous fracture treatment, or having an isolated ankle fracture and not into the tibial diaphysis. So there's a total of 300 periprosthetic tibial fractures around a total knee arthroplasty in 285 patients. So 43% were in primary total knee replacements and 57% in revision total knee replacements. Fractures were classified according to the Felix definition, not the AO technique, but Felix definition, where type 1 was tibial plateau, type 2 was adjacent to the stem, type 3 was distal to the stem, or type 4 was tibial tubercle. And they had subtypes to it. So A is well fixed, B is loose, and C is intraoperative fracture. So I can give you all...
Can I just say I had like such a problem with this, because I'm used to like type 1 is usually the best and type 4 is the worst. Like that's just sort of a conventional. You go from lowest to highest. And this is kind of the other way around. Type 1 is the worst.
Depending, right? According to the study. And that's what's confusing about this. As you said, typically it's like, okay, well, worst always shows one thing or the best always show one thing. But in this case, we'll cut to the chase here, is that, you know, in one area, intraoperative, one's bad. And in the postoperative, another one's bad. So that is confusing. I completely agree. The range of age of patients was 12 to 92 years old, which I found surprising just because I don't do a lot of total knee replacements in 12-year-olds. And 64% of the patients were female, which we expect.
you do a lot more cases if you started indicating 12-year-olds.
And then I get revisions from it, and I get re-revisions and re-revisions too. So a lot of opportunity there. So intraoperative fracture incidence was 0.1% in primary total knee replacements and 1.4% in revision total knee replacements. And the majority of intraop fractures, 78% of them were type 1 for intraoperative fractures. And remember that because it's the flip side for the other one. And the common mechanism of fracture included impaction of the trial or real components or removal of the tibial, prior tibial component that's for the revisions. So at 2 years after the fracture, survivorship free from any reoperation was 87%. Survivorship free from any revision was 94%. And survivorship free from tibial component revision was 97%. And was significantly associated with fracture type. So the survivorship free at 2 years from the tibial component revision was highest in type 1. So interestingly, you say type 1 is bad because it's a tibial plateau fracture. But if you identified it at the time of surgery and it addressed it, then the survivorship was 100%. But if you have a tibial tubercle fracture and it happened during surgery, even if you addressed it, they had the lowest survivorship at 67%. So 13 knees or 9% of intraoperative fractures underwent subsequent revision of total knee involving the total knee replacement and the tibial component specifically for a variety of factors, including infection, aseptic loosening, knee dislocation, and persistent fracture nonunion. And one knee did undergo an above knee amputation 4 years after fracture, and they couldn't find out what the indication was. Now, there's a bunch of other revisions not involving the tibial component. Again, infection is a big one, aseptic loosening, traumatic arthrotomy, adverse losal tissue reaction for a modular total femoral replacement, stiffness, and additional unidentified one. And then 9 additional knees had reoperation for limited range of motion, increased fracture displacement, persistent nonunion, acute mechanism tear, and septic prepatellar bursitis and PJI. Now, that's all the intraoperative stuff. Now we're going to the postoperative stuff. So for the postoperative stuff, the cumulative incidence of postoperative fractures in primary knees was 0.1% at 1 year and then 0.2% at 10 years. For revision total knee arthroplasties, it was 0.3 at 1 year and 1.0 at 10 years. Postoperative fractures were most commonly sustained through low energy or atraumatic mechanism. And the use of cementless fixation was not significantly associated with fracture incidence for intraop or postoperative fractures. So how did this break down for survivorship free from any reoperation? Much lower here when it was postoperative. 29%. At 2 year survivorship free from any revision was 50%. And 2 year survivorship free from tibial component revision was 51%. So type 1 postoperative fracture had the lowest 2 year survivorship free from tibial component revision, which was 10%, versus type 3 had the highest survivorship at 88%. So thinking about it, if you're at the tibial plateau, you see a subsided implant, you're probably going to revise that tibial component's coming out. You're distal in the shaft, you're probably going to plate, non-weight-bearing, nail, whatever it is to get to that area. So it's the flip from the intraoperative fracture. The mean time to revision for aseptic loosening involving the tibial component was 2.5 years, a range of 104 days to 4 years following the fracture. And after post-op fracture treatment, following the initial treatment of post-operative fractures, again, the 2 year survivorship went up. So the amount of reoperation that happened after the initial fixation, the revision fixation was 71%. From those free from revision was 87%. And then free from revision of the tibial component was 88%. So the take-home message that the author said was intraoperative periprosthetic fracture of the tibia was 14.4 more likely in revision total knee arthroplasties compared with primary knee arthroplasties. And we saw that it was well tolerated with type 1 fractures. It was intraoperative, but not well managed or had a higher rate of revision or lower survivorship if they had type 1 tibial plateau fractures in the postoperative area. So it's good that they differentiate between intraoperative and postoperative tibia fractures. I would love to see an AO classification to see if there was differences. It is an expansion of a previous series with long follow-up, which is a good thing, but it didn't actually do anything about the classification. The title stated that they were doing classification and it was using the same classification that was previously there. I'd love to know your input.
Yeah, so my thoughts on this study are that, they say this is the largest and most comprehensive series with 300 periprosthetic tibial fractures. When I initially read the title, 300 periprosthetic tibial fractures, I was imagining someone who has a total knee, they fall at home. And, you know, it's something analogous to a series with Vancouver B1, B2 fractures around a total hip implant. That's what I was imagining. But this is a very heterogeneous cohort that includes these incredibly broad age range, 12 to 92, and then also the intraoperative fractures versus the postoperative fracture component. And I would maintain that those are two completely different animals. A fracture that occurs in an idealized setting, if you will, a laboratory setting, which is the OR, versus that which is found in nature when a patient falls down. The fracture morphology, the underlying drivers of it are likely to be totally different. And therefore, you're sort of creating confounding here just based on this broad range of age, and marrying the intraoperative with the postoperative leads you to findings that may not apply to an intraoperative or a postoperative if you're trying to just sort of say, like, all we're taking all comers together. I would have liked and maintained, from a methodology standpoint, you should probably have limited this to like 55 and older. So it really is like your typical total knee population. It may be good to present the total knee intraoperative fractures as a separate rationale from those that, again, are occurring sort of in the natural environment. And then I don't know if the findings would be the same. I mean, certainly we know what the narrative is in terms of like the outcomes. And I think that makes sense. Like, obviously, if you're damaging the extensor mechanism, that's going to change things to a much greater degree than if you have a tibial plateau fracture that you can otherwise, you know, put in a larger poly or just the base plate. I mean, I think there's, you have a lot more with a small compromise of the tibial plateau, correct me if I'm wrong, then you have a lot more options than you do probably if the tibial tubercle has evolved.
Agreed.
Yeah. So, I think that the statement that this is the largest and most comprehensive series, while factual, that in and of itself needs to be put on hold from a clinical application standpoint, in my opinion. I would have liked a cohort that was more clinically relevant to the standard total knee population and with less of these like two separate non-intersecting Venn circles as far as the etiology of the fracture.
Totally agree with that. All right. You heard it from the mouth. Don't just expand things. Although a good start, always nice to have more information. All right. We're going to talk to your headline, Dr. Schoenfeld. Perioperative opioid counseling for patients undergoing anterior cruciate ligament reconstruction, a randomized controlled trial by Packer et al. There's a commentary, an infographic, and 30-day free. It just needs a visual summary. Tell us more about this.
All right. So this is the CARE trial, an investigator-initiated single-center parallel-arm randomized controlled trial. It was registered on clinicaltrials.gov. And basically, the patients in the treatment group were instructed to take oxycodone only as a quote-unquote last resort if the pain became unbearable, with a stated goal of using as little oxycodone as possible. And then patients in the control group were told to take oxycodone as needed for severe pain and to quote-unquote stay ahead of the pain. So both cohorts received kind of standard regional nerve blocks, cryotherapy, bracing, aspirin, 81 milligrams twice daily for 2 weeks. They include that, but I suspect that's the DVT prophylaxis, not intended for pain management. But they got Tylenol every 6 hours and ibuprofen 800 every 8 hours. They have a sample size calculation based on the assumption that the control group would consume an average of 75 milligrams of morphine equivalent, which is essentially equal to 10 5-milligram oxycodone tablets. On the basis of this assumption, they needed at least 80 patients for 90% power for a 40% reduction in TME with a two-sided alpha. Ultimately, they included 121 patients, 60 in the treatment group and 61 in the control group. Now, the first thing that comes to mind for me is who's going to sign up for an RCT on the restriction of opioids? And that's likely to be folks who are interested in restricting opioids. The person who's very concerned about their pain control after a procedure and is more focused on making sure they have as little pain as possible and therefore have as much medication available to them is probably not going to really be a part of the RCT. With that in mind, they found at 3 months after surgery, the treatment group had consumed a mean of 46 milligrams of TME compared with 63.6 in the control group, and that was statistically significant. The average TME consumption over the first 2 weeks was 26 in the treatment group and 53.5, also statistically significant. And then 22 patients in the treatment group and 6 in the control group did not use any opioids in the 3 months after surgery, which was also statistically significant. So basically a 3.8 increase in risk. In the 14 days after surgery, the mean score for pain at that moment was 2.5 in the treatment group and 2.4 in the control group. Worst pain within the past 12 hours, averaged over the 14 days, was 3.9 in the treatment group and 3.8 in the control group. So what does this all amount to? I think over the years, we've seen a lot of studies that essentially substantiate you are able to effectively treat surgical interventions really across the board, maybe not, very intensive spine surgeries or hip and knee replacements, but, these studies have been done in knee art meniscectomy, ACL here, hand surgery, using Tylenol and Advil is equivalent to Vicodin or Norco, doing something like this, also equivalent, really no difference in outcomes, and they're using less opioids. So across the board, that's a win. It's a proof of concept that's been shown before. I think there's a little bit of, some bias baked into what the patients were being told, because they weren't given, especially in the group that was allowed to take the oxycodone sort of freely, they were told to stay ahead of the pain, which to me, that's like actually encouraging to take it even if they don't need it, which I think in some ways could potentially, bias the outcome here. I think the approach would have been better had they said, refrain from taking the oxycodone unless you have a score of 6 out of 10 pain or 7 out of 10 pain or whatever it is. And the other group could have still been told, look, it's just a last resort. Really try to treat it with everything else you can. But again, that's also an encouragement that's leaning toward a reinforcement of what I suspect is this group's just general predisposition, which is that you're signing up for an RCT about reducing opioids if you're concerned about opioids and you actually want to reduce their use any way possible. So that's the problem that you have with RCT sometimes, is that the people who sign up for them have underlying motivations that sort of reinforce the outcome of the RCT that can cut across both ways. But in this regard, I mean, it's a reasonable issue that it's almost to me like the group that was using the oxycodone was really, it wasn't just left at, leave it to your own devices. They were actually being like kind of encouraged to take the oxycodone. And that can certainly bias the results. Doesn't necessarily bias the outcomes other than the amount of oxycodone that they were using, which this study was obviously hoping to find a difference.
We had that's great. We had a pain study and it is always biased, right? People who want to participate, it's more so they don't want to have to be in the opioid group, or they want more and they don't want to participate in it. So I completely agree with you on that. All right. We're going to go on to our next one then. We're going to talk about long-term mortality associated with periprosthetic infection in total hip arthroplasty, a registry study of 4,651 revisions for infection. This is by Campbell et al. And we're talking about mortality in periprosthetic joint infection. The mortality associated with PJI has been compared to the mortality of common cancers such as breast cancer and prostate cancer, and has a higher mortality rate than one would actually think. That said, most studies on mortality are based on short-term mortality, typically 1 year. So the beauty of this study is using a larger registry, specifically the Australian Orthopaedic Association National Joint Replacement Registry, to determine the long-term mortality associated with revision total hip arthroplasty for infection and associated risk factors. So note that this is just focused on hips, not on knees. This is looking at total hip procedures done for osteoarthritis between September 1, 1999 to December 31, 2022. And the nice thing about this system is they have a national death index, similar to our Social Security death index, to obtain the information on the date of death. Patients who had a first revision for fracture were excluded from the analysis of mortality. And mortality risk was calculated using standardized mortality ratios, or SMRs, comparing the observed mortality to the expected mortality of each cohort based on Australian period life tables from 1999 to 2022 provided by the Australian Bureau of Statistics. And it's adjusted for age, gender, and calendar year of the procedure. If SMR values greater than one are a mortality rate that is more than expected in the general population, and SMR values less than one is a mortality rate that is less than expected in the general population. Patients with bilateral revisions were classified according to the reason for revision associated with their first recorded revision procedure. Kaplan-Meier estimates of survivorship were used to summarize the overall survival following the primary and first revision total hip arthroplasty, and risk factors associated with mortality were identified using Cox proportional hazard model adjusted for age and gender. What were the results? There were 5,048 and 61 primary total hip procedures for osteoarthritis. For the first revision procedure, there was 4,651, and that was in the title there. And then there were 15,891 first revisions for reasons other than infection and fracture. For 110,391, or 20% of the procedures, the patient died with no revision procedure recorded. The group that underwent revision for infection compared to the unrevised primary total hip group were more likely to be male, have a higher proportion with an ASA score of greater than 2 at the time of the procedure, and were more likely to have class 2 or 3 obesity. At all time points, mortality rates after revision for infection were higher than the mortality rates after revision for other reasons and mortality rates after unrevised primary surgery. At 5 years, the mortality rate for revision for PJA was 14.5%. At 10 years, it was 34.7%. And at 15 years, it was 57.5%. Pretty high numbers for mortality. Patients who underwent revision for periprosthetic joint infection had higher mortality rates than expected compared with the general population, and that SMR was 1.31. And if you're undergoing a primary total hip arthroplasty, your SMR was 0.81, which is positive, or aseptic revision, which is 0.95, again, which is a good finding. The higher SMR following revision for periprosthetic joint infection was observed in patients less than 65 years of age at 2.01, in female patients at 1.46, and continued to increase beyond 15 years. Patients with an ASA score of 3 to 5 had greater higher mortality rates than those with ASA scores 1 to 2, with a hazard ratio of 1.9. And this is after adjustment for age and gender. Interestingly, patients who were classified as underweight who underwent revision for PJI had significantly higher mortality compared to patients with a normal BMI who underwent revision, with a hazard ratio of 8.21, which is pretty high. There was no differences in mortality rates for patients with obesity compared to those with normal BMI who underwent revision for PJI. There was no significant difference in mortality rates when comparing minor versus major surgery for PJI or major revisions. A minor revision was an exchange of modular components, such as an acetabular liner or femoral head. Or if you're doing a major revision, it's a removal of any periprosthetic component fixed to bone. There was no significant interactions between major versus minor PJI revision with regards to age or ASA score. There was also no difference in mortality rates when the time from the primary total hip procedure to revision for infection was assessed. The cumulative percent survival was similar for revision for PJI less than equal to 30 days or greater than 30 days from the primary operation. And there was no difference when you're looking at 60 days, less than 60 days, greater than 60 days, 1 year or greater than 1 year to 2 years, and greater than 2 years. So in conclusion, patients revised for total hip replacement patients revised for infections had increased mortality rates compared with the general population and those undergoing primary total hip or aseptic revision. This excess risk persisted beyond 15 years, especially in younger patients. This is good data to know, and it's obviously important to understand that mortality rates are higher in infected patients. But can we really use this to counsel patients? Do you want to tell patients undergoing a primary total hip arthroplasty for osteoarthritis that you're more likely to die if you're younger, female, and have higher ASA and you're underweight? I think these are some things that we have to look at. Can we optimize patients from an ASA 3 to 5 to an ASA 1 or 2, which is very difficult? You're not changing age and you're not changing gender or not changing sex. But if you're underweight, maybe we can improve that. So it's good information to have, and the infection truly is dangerous and has high mortality rates in our patients. So we're going to move on to our last section here on honorable mentions. The first one is immobilization time for conservative treatment of distal radius fractures in elderly patients, a randomized controlled trial. This is by Sala Pujols et al., and there's a commentary. This study aimed to compare pain control, functional outcomes and complication rates between 4 and 6 weeks immobilization periods in elderly patients treated with non-operatively for displaced distal radius fractures, understanding that shorter duration is probably better for patients. This study found that 4 weeks provide equivalent pain control, functional outcomes, and complication rates as 6 weeks immobilization. So shorter is actually better in this case. 5-year functional outcomes after acetabular labral repair with and without bone marrow aspirate concentrate by Martin et al. It's permanently free. So BMAC, which is bone marrow aspirate concentrate augmentation at the time of hip arthroscopy, is a potential solution to improve functional outcomes in patients with cartilage damage concomitant with acetabular labral tearing. So patients undergoing acetabular labral repair with BMAC augmentation had significantly greater functional improvements compared to patients undergoing repair without BMAC. Now that said, the results didn't really become significant until 2 years or 24 months after surgery, and they increased in magnitude in terms of benefit until 60 months post-op. So the first intermediate term outcomes were reported in the study, but maybe we need to follow our hip arthroscopy patients for longer to see potentially benefit of extended follow-up in patients who received BMAC. Now note that the study went out to 5 years. And finally, an ultra-short cementless femoral hip prosthesis, a concise follow-up at 10 years of a previous report by Nielsen et al. This study is on the long-term 10-year follow-up of the previous 2- and 5-year follow-up studies and evaluates bone mineral density, RSA, which is radiostereometric analysis to allow to look at implant movement, and patient-reported outcome measures in patients treated with the Primoris stem, which is an ultra-short cementless femoral hip prosthesis and total hip replacements. This included 50 younger patients. Their mean age was 52 years with end-stage osteoarthritis and normal femoral anatomy received the implant. The bone mineral density in the proximal femur decreased by 7.8% at 120 months. And RSA showed initial subsidence that was comparable to those of standard cementless stems from 5 to 10 years. The difference, though, is it did show a slight varus tilt in the stem, and clinical results were promising in all PROMs by 10 years. Thanks so much for joining us. We always have a good time with you guys, and please tune in next time.